Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankford. Welcome you to the October 12th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesday of every month. Every other fifth Wednesday, when I open the phones to you, our listeners. Actually, I'm going to open the phones to you today, later in the program, because I've made a change in the program. I want to give you an opportunity to share your thoughts on last week's presidential debate, at least if it's billed as that, between President Obama and challenger Mitt Romney, and get your takes on this latest version of America's endless election season. That will be starting at about 20 minutes past the hour. Until then, I'm going to offer you my usual take on events that have been occurring since my last program 2 weeks ago, some of which you have probably haven't heard about. One that received much play in the national media was President Obama's decision not to meet with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu when the two were in New York to speak before the UN General Assembly last month, and going beyond that to refer to the Israeli Prime Minister's demand that the administration set red lines which, if breached by Iran, would result in a U.S. attack on Tehran's nuclear facilities as so much quote-unquote noise. Given the outsized role the U.S.-Israeli relationship has played in the campaign and the question of how much of the overwhelming Jewish support that Obama received in 2008 might be sliced away by the overwhelming Jewish support that Obama received in by Romney's repeated accusations that the president has thrown Israel under the bus, the president's apparent disdain for his Israeli counterpart startled observers across the entire political spectrum, including yours truly. What I and others must have wondered has suddenly, what has suddenly given the president a backbone? The answer may have been revealed in a recently released poll by the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, which describes itself as bipartisan. That means it is backed financially by rich Republicans and rich Democrats, and which I would suspect was shown to the president before he made his decision to snub Netanyahu, being from Chicago as well. What it reveals is something that I have maintained for a long time, that the notion perpetrated by political elites from left to right, that Israel is widely popular among the American people, and that this is the basis for its support by Congress, is little more than a myth, which explains why you haven't heard about it on NPR or anywhere else. Here's what the poll reveals. Only 38% of Americans believe the U.S. should militarily back Israel should it attack Iran. Only 49% would support the U.S. coming to Israel's assistance if it is attacked by its neighbors. 70% oppose the U.S. launching a military strike on Iran without U.N. authorization, which it will never get. Apparently, without being informed of the amounts, 41% of those polled are for aid to Israel either being decreased or stopped altogether. And while Israel's favored over the Palestinians by 30% to 3%, 65% believe the U.S. should not take either side. I'll repeat that. While Israel is favored over the Palestinians by 30% to 3%, the remaining 65% believe the U.S. should not take either side. Moreover, 52% of those polled believe the U.S. should be talking to Hamas. So when our next congressional representative or any of our other politicians tell us of his or her unshakable support for Israel, you can let them know that they are out of touch with the sentiments of the majority of the American people. Whether President Obama got that message from the poll, we may learn when he and Romney engage in their second debate on October 16th, when the subject will be foreign policy. The last president to stand up to Israel in the Israel lobby was George Herbert Walker Bush in 1991, when he refused to approve $10 billion in loan guarantees for Israel. This ended up bringing down the government of Itzhak Shamir in Israel and may have cost Bush a second term, even though his stand had won him the overwhelming support of the American people in polls taken after he had gone on national television, September 12, 1991, explaining his decision and told Americans how much in U.S. aid every Israeli man, woman, and child was receiving from their tax monies. This enraged the Israel lobby, and the political elite of both parties with connections to Israel, who then began a systematic campaign to undermine his presidency, and one that, with the election of Bill Clinton, was ultimately successful. The Israel-Palestine issue is only one category, however, in the comprehensive poll, which is titled Foreign Policy in the New Millennium, Results of the 2012 Chicago Council Survey of American Public Opinion and U.S. Foreign Policy. Among its other findings were that, considering the cost and benefits to the United States, by 67% to 32%, the majority of Americans now believe that neither the Iraq nor Afghanistan wars were worth it, and that only 30% believe these wars have made the country more safe. There is also what the survey described as a solid majority, 71%, that believes that the experience of the Iraq War should make nations more cautious about using military force to deal with quote-unquote rogue states, and almost an equal number, 70%, believe the Iraq War has worsened relations with the Muslim world. At the same time, while opposing by overwhelming majorities any direct U.S. military action in Syria or arming the Syrian opposition, 58% would support the establishment of a no-fly zone, which could not be implemented, however, without the threat of retaliation and subsequent U.S. intervention. Well, that latter part was not mentioned in the poll. The survey found that most Americans are more interested in what's happening in Asia and U.S. relations with China than with either the Middle East or Europe, apart from their concern for maintaining a steady flow of oil. Overall, the number one foreign policy priority was protecting the jobs of American workers, 83%, and reducing dependency on foreign oil, 77%, both of which had gone up by several percentage points since the last poll in 2010. Those were followed by preventing the spread of nuclear weapons, 72%, down a point, and combating international terrorism, 64%, down 5 percentage points from 2 years ago. Maintaining our military power and controlling illegal immigration followed at 53%, both slightly down since 2010. And climate change? It was ninth at 33%, 2 percentage points less than 2010, which may explain why neither the president nor Romney nor any of our politicians are talking about it. Pretty sad. The poll was conducted for Chicago Council between May 25th and June 8th, among what it described as, quote, a representative national sample, unquote, of 1,702 adults. The council also commissioned a smaller oversample of 175 millennials, those between 18 and 29 years old, yielding a total sample of 1,877 adults and a margin of sampling error of plus or minus 2.8 points. The survey was conducted by GFK Custom Research, a polling social science and market research firm in Palo Alto. And you can read it yourself by going online and Googling Chicago Council on Global Affairs. In Kabul, Afghanistan, some say that if you listen closely, you can hear the sound of helicopters lifting off from the roofs of the U.S. Embassy in Saigon in 1975. It has gotten that bad in Obama's war, yet U.S. pilots continue to accidentally kill Afghan civilians, the last instance, reported instance at least, being 8 women hunting for firewood, whose lives obviously are not nearly as important as that of an American ambassador in Libya or his fellow embassy employees, and consequently it is unthinkable that members of the women's families, unlike the U.S. government, might be seeking revenge. On October 1st, New York Times reported that, quote, only 2 days after joint operations between American and Afghan forces were said to be returning to normal, 5 people, 2 Americans and 3 Afghans, were killed when a pitched battle broke out between the soldiers of the 2 sides, American and Afghan. According to the paper, quote, Afghan officials said that the clash was a misunderstanding and that the Americans apparently attacked an Afghan National Army unit in error. The story goes on. A top coalition officer said the Americans were attacked first in what might possibly be an insurgent attack. Nonetheless, he expressed regret for what ensued. Midway in the article was this most revealing passage, the importance of which apparently escaped the Times reporter. Significantly, he wrote, according to Afghan officials, the American unit, which is relatively small in size and manning a temporary checkpoint in the Saidabad district, was not partnered with Afghan forces. The unit was conducting a biometric survey in which details like fingerprints and eye scans are gathered from the local population, often at temporary checkpoints in an effort to screen for insurgents, end quote. Such humiliations of the Afghan people by culturally insensitive American soldiers seem to me not out of the ordinary for Times reporter Rod Nordland, but one can imagine the feelings of Afghans who are being so manhandled by foreigners in their own country and have been so for the past 11 years. Journalist and blogger William Bloom, former guest on the show, writes in Counterpunch last week that, quote, in Afghanistan, U.S. military has tried training sessions, embedded cultural advisors, recommended reading lists, and even a video game designed to school American troops in local custom. But 11 years back into the war, he writes, NATO troops and Afghan soldiers are still beset by a dangerous lack of cultural awareness, officials say, contributing to a string of attacks by Afghan police and soldiers against their military partners. 51 coalition troops have been killed this year by their Afghan counterparts. Well, some insider tracks attacks have been attributed to Taliban infiltrators. Military officials say the majority stem from the personal disputes and misunderstandings. So the Afghan army is trying something new, writes Bloom, most likely with American input, a guide to the strange ways of the American soldier. The goal is to convince Afghan troops that when their Western counterparts do something deeply insulting, it's likely a product of cultural ignorance and not worthy of revenge. The pamphlet they produced includes the following advice, quote, please do not get offended if you see a NATO member blowing his or her nose in front of you. When coalition members get excited, they may show their excitement by patting one another on the back or the behind. They may even do this to you if they are proud of the job you've done. Once again, they don't mean to offend you. End quote. Next, when someone feels comfortable in your presence, they may even put their feet on their own desk while speaking with you. They are by no means trying to offend you. They simply don't know or have forgotten the Afghan custom. End quote. Pointing the soles of one's shoes at someone is considered a grievous insult in Afghanistan as well as throughout the Middle East. You may remember the shoe thrown at President Bush by a journalist in Baghdad. Going on. The guide also warns Afghan soldiers that Western troops might wink at them or inquire about their female relatives or expose their private parts while showering, all inappropriate actions by Afghan standards. End quote. Well, our longest war ain't over yet. Wonder what Obama and Romney will have to say about it next Tuesday. Do you think either Joe Biden or Paul Ryan will mention Afghanistan in their debate, quote unquote, tomorrow night? Will they even be asked about it? Going on, changing reels, showing unusual courage. Leaders from the Lutheran, Methodist, and United Church of Christ churches have sent a letter to Congress requesting that U.S. military aid to Israel be contingent, quote, on compliance with applicable U.S. laws and policies, end quote, which specifically rule out their use against civilians, a condition that neither Israel or its Washington benefactors have ever observed. The letter's 15 signatories noted they have, quote, witnessed widespread Israeli human rights violations committed against Palestinians, including killing of civilians, home demolitions and forced displacement, and restrictions on Palestinian movement, among others, end quote. They expressed their, quote, grave concern about the deteriorating conditions in Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories, which threaten to lead the region further away from the realization of a just peace, end quote. Jewish organizations, whose primary activity is to protect Israel, were quick to object. Larry Gold, chair of the Jewish Council for Public Affairs, which bills itself as the, quote, national public affairs arm of the organized Jewish community, end quote, noted that while the letter does acknowledge that Palestinians share responsibility for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and it includes, quote, no call for investigation of Palestinian intransigence, end quote, as if that compared with a litany of Israeli crimes, not to mention violations of U.S. law. Rabbi Noam Marans, the director of interreligious and intergroup relations for the American Jewish Committee, the foreign policy arm of the Israel lobby, condemned the church leaders, claiming that, quote, rather than listening to the voices of the people in the pews who repeatedly have rejected one-sided efforts condemning Israel, these leaders, claiming to want peace, seek yet again to hurt Israel's ability to defend itself, end quote. Strange is it not that a rabbi claims to know more about the thoughts of the parishioners of 15 mainstream churches than the leaders of those churches themselves? Well, that's why we have the word chutzpah. Perhaps a good rabbi should read the Chicago poll. James Risen's report on the costly failure, quote, of one of the nation's biggest domestic counterterrorism programs, end quote, should have been on the front page of the New York Times last Wednesday instead of being buried inside. A congressional investigation into regional intelligence gathering offices known as fusion centers that are financed by the Department of Homeland Security and created jointly with state and local law enforcement agencies reveal that the centers, quote, forwarded intelligence of uneven quality, oftentimes shoddy, rarely timely, sometimes endangering citizens' civil liberties and Privacy Act protections, occasionally taken from already published public sources, and more often than not unrelated to terrorism, end quote. Moreover, the investigators also discovered that federal officials cannot account for as much as $1.4 billion in taxpayer money earmarked for the fusion centers, and that some of the centers listed on the paper by the Homeland Security Department do not even exist. According to the article, top officials of Homeland Security have known about the problems for years, but hid an internal department report on the program flaws from Congress, while continuing to tell lawmakers and the public that the fusion centers were highly valuable and that they formed the centerpiece of Homeland Security's counterterrorism efforts. It might be said that it is a rare day when an article advocating a U.S. attack on Iran's nuclear facilities does not appear in one of our major papers. Indeed, there seems at times to be a competition among them, and if so, the Washington Post, once a respectable newspaper, seems to be in the lead. One of the more, may I say, interesting op-ed pieces, among them headlined, quote, "Providing a Legal Basis to Attack Iran," appeared in the September 27th edition with Jeffrey Smith and John Bellinger III as authors. Neither man was identified by the paper, although it turned out, as my frequent guest Grant Smith discovered, that both Smith and Bellinger, and this other Smith, are employed by the law firm Arnold & Porter, which represents Israel in U.S. courts, most notably in cases brought against Israeli military officers for war crimes. Then last Friday, Michael Singh, managing director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, the AIPAC-spawned think tank whose experts have the run of Capitol Hill and its media, wrote an opinion piece taking Netanyahu's side against that of the president, a more common practice among Washington's Israel-dominated media, stable than not. Under the headline, quote, "A red line that Iran would take seriously," he concluded that, quote, "after Netanyahu's clear statement at the General Assembly, it's up to the Obama administration to suggest a red line that better meets U.S. objectives, as well as a criteria of enforceability and credibility." And when it comes to credibility, claims Singh, "the United States has undermined itself on multiple fronts by rewarding Iranian defiance with better offers at the negotiating table, by enforcing sanctions reluctantly, and by allowing senior officials to speak out publicly against the military option that the president insists remains on the table." Obama is right, he says, to want to avoid conflict with Iran, Singh concedes, but lest his patience be mistaken for apprehension and allies and adversaries alike tune out U.S. warnings, he would be wise to overcome his aversion to red lines, end quote. Michael Singh of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. After Netanyahu's UN speech, a number of media pundits claimed that he was addressing the American people. Those pundits got it wrong. Who Netanyahu was speaking to were the Israel firsters in the mainstream media and the Washington think tanks that function as Israeli propaganda ministries. What he was providing them with was talking points, as should be evident from Michael Singh's pro-war Washington Post opinion piece.